Welcome, everyone. Thanks for coming to the session ICAP Best Practice by GAE today. My name's Rashi and I'm the chair for this session. I'm just going to kick off by introducing GAE and then I'll hand over to her. GAE has worked in GI for over 20 years, mostly as a consultant with Affinity. She's currently the appointed actuary for four insurers and is closely involved with each company's ICAP. She has played a key role in developing Affinity's work around the ICAP, including modelling and reporting. GAE is extremely passionate about the ICAP. She's sharing a little joke here. A couple of years ago, GAE enthused to one of her employees and colleagues, "I love the ICAP." He responded with, "I don't know whether you're serious." GAE was, of course, serious about it. So very excited about hearing about the ICAP from GAE.
Hi, folks. Thank you. Okay. So I apologise on behalf of my colleague, Francis, who was going to be presenting today, but couldn't make it after all. So let's start with the topics I'm going to cover in relation to ICAP today. And I am going to skip through some of the material because when I presented it to myself over the last 24 hours, I discovered there was too much. So we have written a paper. So anything that I've skipped or anything else you would like to know about what we think is in the paper. I'll talk throughout this about some benchmarking we've done. So we, at Affinity, we've benchmarked the ICAPs of about 25 insurers, and they range from, you know, very small branch operations to looking at the large listed companies. And, you know, I guess that's been useful in getting a feel for what's happening in the market about ICAP. I will use, I'll say we, as in we did this, we did that. It's not the royal we. I am kind of talking about Affinity's experience and Affinity's observations generally about what's being done in ICAP. I'm sure because you're here, I don't need to remind you what ICAP is about. It's about linking capital management, risk management, and your risk appetite with the business decisions that are made on a day-to-day basis, as well as strategic decisions. Why Justin Bieber? Well, I'm sure you know that his followers are called Beliebers, and I'm an ICAP Belieber, as Rashi's already mentioned. So why am I a Belieber? Well, what are the positives of having ICAPs in place across our industry? As you can see here, I think there's quite a number, and I'm going to generalise here, but my observation would be that the improvements or the positives of ICAP have generally applied more at the small to medium company end rather than the big companies who were probably already giving very strong focus to capital management. But I think looking across the market as a whole, while capital management has always been a central issue, ICAP frameworks have increased the focus on capital management, probably increased or resulted in better capital monitoring as well. And I think importantly, probably tightened up the discipline around capital. So I think with an ICAP in place and an ICAP process every year, there's less chance of, you know, wishful thinking around capital or ignoring capital issues as they emerge. I think ICAP has generally made stronger links between risk management and capital management and the way business decisions are made. APRA has very firmly and explicitly given responsibility for ICAP to boards, and in our experience, we have definitely seen boards becoming more involved in capital management, taking greater interest and becoming more knowledgeable about capital needs and the volatility of capital and so on. So I think that has been a success in terms of getting the attention of boards and getting the involvement of boards. I'll talk a bit more about ICAP documents in a minute, so I won't talk about them now. I'm also going to spend some time talking about scenario and stress testing and the use of DFA in ICAP. And I think, again, there those have been used better in under ICAP frameworks and have led to stronger understanding for both management and boards of the volatility of capital and the impact of scenarios on the capital position. I've mentioned uniformity here. That's really about the fact that I think ICAP has lifted the level generally across so that we've got consistency from company to company in terms of the sophistication of capital management due to ICAPs being in place. One change we've seen happening is as a result of ICAP and thinking through the issues around capital management, companies have made their risk appetites more sophisticated. So things like making them more granular, having statements of risk tolerances in a range of different areas, making more quantitative statements about what sort of risk appetite a company has and what sort of tolerances it has. And I think that has been an improvement for many companies. We might ask, have any real actions occurred because of ICAAP? So we sort of talk about the framework being in place and risk appetite statements and so on. Has anyone really changed anything because of ICAAP? Well, it's hard, obviously, to say whether a particular change has been a direct impact of ICAAP, but our feeling is that it has made companies think more clearly about their capital position, and you will have seen some things which have been at least partly due to ICAAP introduction, things like perhaps de-risking a business because they've understood the volatility of capital better. We've seen some smaller companies in particular, I guess especially where they don't have ready access to capital, de-risking in different ways, such as, you know, buying more reinsurance and so on. Moving riskier lines of business, perhaps to a Lloyd's syndicate. We've seen on the positive side, I guess, branches being more empowered, I think, to repatriate capital because they've defined this framework, they've defined their target operating range for capital, and that has given them, you know, a framework under which they can repatriate capital where appropriate. So, as I say, I think there are quite a few positives across the industry as a whole from the introduction of ICAAP. Well, of course, there must be some negatives as well. I don't think too much in terms of negatives. You, of course, could always say it's more compliance, and after this morning's session, I don't like to call it compliance. I think it's mandated actions or mandated policies. I guess the more you have of that sort of thing, the more burdensome it is, particularly for insurers at the smaller end of things. And I think, once again, where APRA is intending to be principles-based in the ICAAP space as well as others, sometimes that has tended to turn into quite prescriptive requirements from our regulator. The real test for an ICAAP for either an individual company or for the industry as a whole is how will it help, how will it facilitate recovery when capital is strained? And while in the end having an ICAAP doesn't increase the amount of capital available, I think the path to shoring up your capital position for most companies is better defined, is more streamlined, if you like, so that recovery where recovery is possible will be facilitated by having ICAAP in place. Just to talk a little bit about the ICAAP documents. So first, the policy statement, the ICAAP summary statement. I think for a lot of companies that has been a useful place to put together the thoughts and the plans around capital management. The point I've got there about PCR is kind of not about the report as such, it's more about the policy. GPS 110 requires the company to talk about the basis of capital measurement that they're using for their ICAAP, and we've seen pretty much uniformly everybody is using PCR as their basis of capital management. You know, I don't really know of any companies in particular that are using a different base now, so that's kind of become the universal language of capital. In terms of going back to the document, the ICAAP summary statement, what we're seeing is that that document does tend to need refreshing. I mean, it's just become, I guess, part of the annual document refresh, one of those things that gets looked at every year. I think that's useful. Things usually change enough to require a bit of tweaking every now and again, and you know, as part of that cycle, just thinking about what needs changing. The documents are sometimes longer than they need to be, in my view. We've seen, when we look at the group of insurers, we've benchmarked documents between, say, 10 pages and 35 pages long. I would say that once it gets beyond about 25 pages, it could be getting on the long side. You know, sometimes documents don't get the pruning they need from time to time. They'll have a preamble at the start that's now out of date or could be cut back, or they might include repetition of material that's in other documents. I'm always a fan of punchy, effective documents, and so to the extent that the ICAP summary statement can be made punchier, then I'll be in favour of that. I think more important in terms of the discipline around capital management is the annual ICAP report. And it is, of course, a natural focus every year. You need to prepare this report. You need to look at capital outcomes during the year. You need to think about what's happened and why, and you need to look at your outlook for capital and your plans around capital. And I think having that annual prompt has been a very useful thing for managements and boards, just that drawing attention to it very explicitly once a year. Because insurers have almost uniformly, I think, moved to doing scenario and stress testing on an annual basis, that obviously naturally fits within the ICAP report. It fits alongside the FCR. Almost every company that I know of has synchronised its ICAP report and its FCR, as with its other things, business plan and so on, to work in as at date of the annual balance date. And I think while that kind of packs your year end even more busily than before, it does mean that everything's in sync, and I think it's sort of a cleaner process when everything's kind of done at once. We've seen a number of, particularly in smaller insurers, take the option of including the ICAP report as part of the FCR, and a couple of my clients have done that, and that's worked really well from a operational perspective as well as from a framework perspective. Again, when I look at ICAP reports, I think they're often a bit on the long side. You've probably got a larger range of length with ICAP report. Our benchmarking tells us something between 10 and 70-plus pages at the top end. The bigger the organisation and the more complex with lots of bits and pieces. I mean, you're naturally going to have more detail to talk about in the ICAP report, but once again, I'd be all in favour of, you know, having a good think about whether everything that's there needs to be there, maybe not. I guess when you review an annual document, you know, don't keep everything and add something, you know, think about what can be turfed out from last year. I think it's interesting to stop and think about ICAP review. So at this point, every company has had their independent ICAP review that is mandated at least every 3 years. Almost all companies that I'm aware of have chosen that big review every 3 years rather than taking that sort of rolling option that APRA has given them. When you look at who has done those reviews, so I guess I'd characterise them in four groups. Number one, risk management experts, so people from risk management backgrounds with that sort of qualitative expertise often. You've got had some reviews done by actuaries, so actuaries with our sort of natural skill set tending towards the more technical. Some have been done by external audit firms, which may have a bit of expertise in both of those areas, the qualitative risk management aspects as well as the technical side. And then the fourth group would be internal audit. Sometimes, I think, by nature, when they're done by internal audit, the reviews can be more compliance and sort of ticker box process focused. But when I've looked at the ICAP reviews for the companies I'm involved with, I definitely see a link between who did it and the sorts of findings that you get. So when I've seen one that's been done by a risk management expert, all of the findings may relate to risk management. I've seen one done by an actuary where everything had to do with the numbers and none of it to do with the risk management aspects. Now, I think ideally you do want to have that looking at it from both angles, and so I would be saying to companies, when it comes around next time, you know, think about the angles that you got from your first review and think about, am I going to make sure that my review covers both of those angles? I think it makes for a more effective review in that case. So, yeah, what didn't my review last time? APRA has effectively given us all feedback on our ICAPs when they gave that industry-wide feedback on ICAP summary statements first and then on ICAP reports. I guess the message I felt that was coming from them was they were pretty happy with how things had progressed. And then I think the term they used was better practice, so they gave us a lot of guidance about what was better practice, and which kind of gave us a little bit more prescription, but I think gave us pretty strong ideas of exactly what they were looking for in terms of ICAP. Check watch. Okay, I'll talk. Now, this slide, I want to talk quite a lot about this slide because it's now moving on to the technical side of ICAP and looking at stress and scenario testing. So what I'll first do is talk about the kind of stress and scenario test companies have done and you know, have these tests been done by all insurers or just some? And then I'll come back and talk about how probability or return periods of scenarios can be assessed. First, just to say that I think scenarios and stress tests have almost always been a joint project between board, management and appointed actuary, and I think that's exactly what APRA was looking for. I think that's been a very positive part of the whole ICAP deal. Most companies have done something between, say, 10 and 20 scenarios, including reverse stress tests, as APRA has specified. So what sort of scenarios? Well, every insurer has done some scenarios, of course, around claims costs. They're looking at deterioration in claims costs, both on their existing claims, past claims, and the outstanding claims liability, as well as future claims, future business. Most insurers, well, particularly those where it's relevant, have looked at the impact of CAT events, so the one-off very severe events like the one in 200-year CAT event, as well as perhaps a series of moderately severe events. And again, where it's relevant, I think most insurers have looked at that. Most insurers have also had a look at asset-related risks, so in particular counterparty risks. So that might be reinsurance counterparties or investment counterparties. So having a think about, well, if my reinsurer is downgraded or my bank fails or, you know, it partially fails, then how do things look for us? Most insurers have had a look at some economic downturns, you know, modelling the impact on their portfolio. You know, a GFC-like event has been quite a common scenario. Operational risks are an interesting one because I think they're a bit different in that, a bit arbitrary in terms of what might the event be. I mean, we can all easily sort of do a sensitivity on loss ratios or a sensitivity on investment returns, but thinking about what's my operational risk going to result in, and generally it's been an acknowledgement that there is operational risks, things like fraud, things like IT interruptions and so on, and then kind of in terms of a scenario saying, well, let's just say we have a $10 million loss and, you know, what does that do to us? I think some insurers have decided not to have operational risks in their scenario and stress tests and just keep them in that risk management framework where you're basically looking at the risks and looking at how you're mitigating them without sort of attaching dollar values to them. Scenarios around investment return aren't all that exciting at the moment because investment returns are not a really major part of profitability, unfortunately. But most insurers have had to think about those, and then, as I mentioned, reverse stress tests have been part of what insurers have done. One thing I would say there that in terms of reverse stress tests, well, and stress and scenario tests more broadly, the uniform approach tends to be to do them from your current capital position. So you might be sitting at or near the top of your target operating range for capital, but that's where you've started all your scenarios and stress tests with the current position. And I think that's perfectly sensible. I also think it's crucial, if you're not currently within your target operating range, to think about what those scenarios would do to you if you were, because an insurer has set a target operating range for capital, which by definition means I am happy if my capital position is sitting in that range. And I think it's very important to think about, okay, if I was at or near the bottom of my target operating range, what would these scenarios do to my position? Because I think that's important to understand. So, as I mentioned, I wanted to come back to assessing return periods of scenarios and stress tests. And I also think that's quite crucial because, well, think about it from a board member's perspective. I'm told, well, this scenario will take our capital adequacy multiple to, you know, 1.13. That's bad. But I want to know, well, is that a 1-in-5-year scenario? Is it a 1-in-50-year scenario? Is it a 1-in-1,000-year scenario? So I think it's very important to have that, understand the impact, understand the likelihood. And while assessing return periods is certainly not an exact science, I think it's worth going as far down that path as you can sensibly go. So at Finity, we've developed a few at least quantitative places to start in terms of that. So on claims risks or claims deterioration, what we've got to, as a starting point, is our risk margins. So we've established these risk margins around the liabilities. They imply a distribution of claims outcomes. So in terms of developing return periods for claims costs, why not start with those? What are the distributions implied by those? So we've done that. With all of these sort of analytical methods for coming up with return periods, you've got to sort of overlay some judgment and some sense checks on them. For CAT events, you've got your CAT modelling at the sort of more extreme end of things in terms of assessing return periods. And at the other end, you've got your own experience. Look back over the 5, the 10, the 20 years experience and, you know, come up with some sensible answers about what the return periods of various events might be. Probably the last thing I'll talk about in terms of return period assessment is on the default side of things, looking at probability of default of reinsurer or downgrade of reinsurer and what that might mean. S&P published, I don't know how familiar you are, but these tables of given rating, what is the probability of default and or failure? And we've essentially used them as a starting position in terms of assessing likelihoods of downgrade or default. Yeah, all of that is, it's kind of a mixture of some quantitative stuff and a sort of overlay of judgment and sense checking. Okay, I want to talk a little about an imaginary insurer, just to get a little bit more concrete with some of this. So this is our imaginary insurer, Packy, ICAP, back to front, who writes a mix of short tail and long tail business and has reasonably ready access to additional capital when they need it or if they need it. And Packy has a target operating range for capital adequacy multiple range of 1.6 to 2. So when Packy does the scenario and stress testing, I'm not going to talk through all of these. The tests are an example of this, the range of tests that I've just talked about. But they will look at, you know, starting position, this is where we are, what will our base projection, our business plan projection take us to 1 year out, and looking 1 year out, I can look at the impact of a whole range of scenarios and where might we be. So the second last column there is just in each scenario, how does the projected CAM 1 year out compare to my base projection? So in other words, how much worse are we under that scenario? You can get, I guess, a more quick and ready understanding of which ones cause you trouble by putting it on a graph. So in this case, where Packy's fine under most of those scenarios, mind you, they're starting from a capital position, I forgot to mention, of 2.2, which is above their target range. So you'd hope that they will be fine under most scenarios. But scenarios 3 and 8 get them into the troublesome zone. And so the next question, of course, is, well, how likely are scenarios 3 and 8? In this case, scenario 3 is the 1 in 200-year property cat. Doesn't seem like something that should make us too anxious, that the 1 in 200 year is going to have a big impact on us, and the other one is the 100 year economic downturn. So in this particular case, nothing too troubling in terms of immediate impacts and you know, none of the more plausible or likely scenarios are causing any sort of troubling impacts on the company. Just very briefly to mention this idea of, you know, 1 year or multi-year scenarios. APRA specified 1 year horizon for doing scenario and stress testing, and almost all companies in my experience have stuck to the 1 year horizon. I think that's absolutely fine. Some things naturally lend themselves to being done as a multi-year scenario, things like a liability claims cost deterioration. Once you get into multi-year scenario thinking, though, it becomes much more complex, you know. If something is going to unfold over a number of years, you're going to be thinking about, oh, yes, but if that happened or this is what I saw after 1 year, what might I do? There would be a management response potentially, and then what would the impact of that be? And then you get into this sort of universe of multiple prongs of possibility, and obviously in those circumstances assessing probabilities is more difficult. But I certainly think while 1 year horizon is fine, I mean, perhaps it's worth thinking through multi-year possibilities. I think, APRA is wanting companies, when it comes down to it with this scenario and stress testing, is to come up with a view of, is the company in its current operations, its current business, consistent with its risk appetite? And that's certainly not easy, but with what you know from scenario and stress testing, as well as potentially a DFA, if you have a DFA model, is you can get some boundaries around that and sort of zero in on a sensible answer. PACI, this imaginary company, has a risk appetite that says we want a less than 10% chance of our CAM dropping below one. And what they've done is a couple of reverse stress tests. So reverse stress test R1 here starts from their current CAM, 2.2-ish, and yes, in this scenario, their CAM could reduce to 1 in 1 year. That's a 1 in 50 year scenario, so probability of 2%. The second reverse stress test there is starting from the bottom of their target operating range. It's a 1 in 25 year scenario, so they could go to 1 from the bottom of their target operating range with a probability of 4%. So you've got two scenarios there that are going to take them to a CAM of 1 or lower if they were sitting at the bottom of their target operating range. So we can see that if they're at that point in their target operating range, the probability is roughly 4 to 6%, and definitely more than that because there are other circumstances that would also take the CAM lower than 1. And I think it's kind of like a process of triangulation. You do reverse stress tests, you think about each, how independent are they, what are the probabilities, or my best guess at the probabilities, and kind of put it all together with a layer of judgment and sense checking. But, you know, that's not an easy step, but I think it's a doable step. And it's certainly better than not trying to do it at all. I was going to talk about DFAs and their usefulness in ICAP, but I think it's kind of fairly obvious, and we talk about that in the paper, and I'm not going to talk about those either. Just a little bit of benchmarking, thinking about all else being equal, where would your target operating range sit depending on the company's circumstances? So this is what this table is addressing, so I'll just work through the examples. What sort of factors about a company could mean their target operating range could sit lower? Subsidiaries and branches, I guess, are the obvious one to start with. So if a subsidiary or branch has a well-capitalised parent or home office, then they will have the luxury, if you like, of setting their target operating range lower, because if they do start to approach an uncomfortable position, they will have access to capital fairly readily. And when we look at our benchmarked companies, we do see that, all other things being equal, it looks like subsidiaries and branches might be sitting maybe 0.1 or 0.2 lower in terms of a CAM, multiples of PCR, that is. Long-tail insurers, well, it's not simple when you think this through, I don't think, because for a start, obviously your PCR is higher for long-tail business. If you think about long-tail business, depending on the nature of the scenario unfolding, management may have more time to respond than they would do to a sort of property event, which hits instantly, for example. So could you argue that long-tail insurers could have their target operating range at a lower multiple of PCR than other insurers? You could argue that way. You could probably find counter-arguments as well. What we do see when we look at our benchmarked companies is that purer liability insurers tend to have a higher target operating range. Possibly part of that is just human beings liking to have margins on margins and not quite believing that the PCR does enough work for you. But that is what we observe. Heavily reinsured companies could, because of lower volatility, potentially sit a bit lower. Hard to assess from our benchmarking. Multi-line insurers with greater diversification could also potentially sit lower in the range. And listed companies are kind of almost in their own class, in that listed companies obviously have quite public and stringent capital, return on capital requirements, so they obviously need to think and active and manage their capital much more actively than many other companies, and so you do observe that their target operating ranges are sitting lower, basically because they can't waste additional capital. I'm almost there, because I'm going to skip this one. In terms of companies defining their target operating range for capital, I think pretty much every company I've seen has a target operating range, usually, well, 100% have defined the bottom. So that's clearly the most important part of your target range, is where you will not want to step. Some companies have a top, but not all. Some will actually specify a sort of point target, so this is our ideal position, 2.3 or whatever it may be. And then there's a bit of diversity around, you know, here's our target range. We'll have some trigger points within that range for thinking and or action. We'll have trigger points above that range for thinking and or action, and there will be some below as well. You know, when do we talk to APRA? When do we actually pull the trigger in terms of getting extra capital? One thing is that, in my observation, most insurers are very happy to be sitting above their target operating ranges, and many are at the moment. And, again, I think that's human nature. Nobody wants to reduce their capital position unless they have to, I think. The listed insurers, as I mentioned, do need to be actively managing that more than others. And just to end with a little thought about what might ICAPs do over the next, you know, 5 years, say, what developments might we see, how might they change? I don't think we'd be expecting anything dramatic. ICAPs are pretty well set, pretty well thought about. They're, in my observation, reasonably well embedded into business decisions and strategy decisions, but, you know, that's probably a process that's continuing, the embedding of ICAPs. I would like to see companies think, when it comes to the big three-year review next time, what did I get out of the last one? Did it provide me value? Did it look at things from all angles, and could I get more value out of my next one? I suspect that ICAPs will get some refinement when the big challenge comes, either at an individual company level or across the industry. I guess you only find out what's wrong in some ways when something goes wrong and deficiencies are made clear. So maybe they'll need to adapt in response when the trouble comes, whatever the trouble may be. I think reports, I'd be hoping some of them would get streamlined and cut down. To some extent, I think at the moment target operating ranges reflect what capital people had, or companies had, I should say. Maybe over time those will get refined as, you know, a natural part of the process. I think some companies are clearly still on a journey in terms of refining their risk appetite, so making it more granular, making it more quantitative, and I'm certainly aware of companies that are still going down that path, and, you know, I think that's generally a positive path for most companies. Like everything else, of course, ICAP will need regular pruning and maintenance, so just your yearly think, your yearly refresh, your yearly is it still working for us type questions. Thank you. That's the end of what I wanted to say.
Thank you so much. So we've got around about 5 to 7 minutes for questions. So can we kick off with questions? Can I ask people to come up to the microphone and just introduce themselves and ask questions so we can get that for the recording? Thanks, Andy.
Oh, sorry, Andy. Thanks, Kay. Ben Wang from IAG. Given that you've reviewed a lot of ICAPs, have you seen any good examples of companies communicating the risk appetite effectively? So, for example, you might say, okay, our target range is 1.5 times the APRA minimum, and that will make sure that we survive 1% of cases. That can mean different things to different board members, especially when different board members are, some are more numerically literate than others. I mean, even if you say it in a way such as, like, that means you survive 1 in 100 years, again, some board members might not have the right context as to what would cause a 1 in 100-year failure versus a 1 in 50-year failure.
I certainly have seen boards where that sort of concept has been communicated really well, and I wouldn't be able to say exactly what the factor has been. I think it's, to be honest, I think it's about the board rather than about the way it's communicated. I think if you've got a board who has got the sophistication and the interest, they will naturally inquire and you know, satisfy themselves and kind of ask the right questions. I guess I would say that most boards that I'm familiar with have I think it's not just because of ICAP, but I think they have, well, boards are tending towards people with more relevant expertise and the capacity to get on top of, you know, the technical as well. I feel like I'm not really answering the question in that, look, I guess I don't have anything that I would point to, but I think the more you try, the more you put material out there, the more you discuss it, then yes, you are going to get there because people are hopefully going to challenge you. I didn't quite understand what does that mean. And I'll tell you one thing I have seen. Some boards in particular love coming up with black swan scenarios. They love nothing more than having a big workshop and thinking up, oh, now what if this happened and then that happened and these total disaster scenarios. And, you know, I sometimes it's a bit ridiculous, I think, but it, I think it's also a good thing because it's an indicator of them really engaging in the process and really wanting to think about it. So I think it's part of that dynamic between management and board.
Hello, Andy White from QBE. On the scenarios, and particularly return periods, one of the challenges is that what you really want for the ICAP is a non-exceedance probability for a loss of that size, not the probability of that specific event.
Yep.
Have you seen anyone articulate that particularly well? Because I'm going to be honest, I personally struggle when you sat down with an underwriter to explain what you're after in plain English before they fall asleep.
I think my short answer is no. I don't think I've really seen... I mean, it gets quite tricky quite quickly, doesn't it, when you really try and think about that. And I think...
Have you seen people even try? Or I mean, because you can just wimp out, ask the easy question, which is what's the probability of this scenario, even though that's not what you actually want. Mm. Or you can try and ask the question and see how far you get.
I have certainly... I'm thinking of one colleague in particular who talks about those sorts of things with his client, and I think that works well in that particular situation, you know, just introducing that. It's sort of like another dimensional concept, isn't it? I don't think it's going to work all the time, but maybe that's the next level. Maybe that's something for ICAPs, you know, in the next few years as sophistication levels evolve a little bit more even.
Cool. Thanks.
Clive Amory, AM Actuaries. Thanks, Gay. It's good to get some insights into how other ICAP products are being done. My question is to do with the trigger points. What sort of detail are you seeing there of management and boards willing to go to when the ratio starts getting very low? You know, you're getting down to 1.2s. There'll be some motherhood statements saying, yes, we'll raise some capital. Are you seeing anyone really querying that or putting some flesh to the bones on how they'd actually go about that?
As in how to get the capital, you mean?
Yes. Or? Yeah, so it's very easy to say, well, raise capital, should we get down to there?
Yep.
But some entities, not the listed companies and that, they probably have access to the capital markets, but smaller entities, what are they doing in that space?
Well, I would say I have seen companies thinking that through when, as we've worked through them with them, that's one of the, you have to have a think about this, you know, you have to cover that off in your ICAP report and, or ICAP summary statement. And as I said, we've seen some companies go through that process and then think, gee, you know, we would be really up against it if X, Y, Z, and really think, okay, maybe we need to change something here. We need to reduce our PCR or we need to increase our capital. And I have seen, which I refer to, companies having that path defined at least. It doesn't make it easy necessarily to get the capital, but I guess I would say I have seen a level of sophistication around at least defining the path to additional capital and, you know, what's our priority order? You know, first, think about this, this and this. Second, yeah, so I think I have seen that, yeah. And again, with not just the path to capital, but the trigger points, you know, at this point, when we reach blah, blah, we will put the first steps, you know, we'll notify whoever needs to be notified, and then the next step will be, depending on how we go, we'll think about, are we still going down at this point or can we naturally recover and so on. So, yeah, I think generally I have seen that be quite sophisticated, or as sophisticated as it possibly could be.
Chow Chow, people, you see, from the ICAPs I've seen, there's one thing that I always challenge myself with, and that is I see a lot of people having this tick-the-box behaviour. It's sort of you getting your pink slip and say, oh, right, I'll check my brakes, I'll check my windscreen, nothing's happening. But how do you get yourself in the mindset that, hey, I actually can use this as an opportunity to do something? So instead of saying, oh, I'll check my brakes, maybe I say, well, here's an enhancement I can make to my vehicle. Or, you know, instead of ticking the box and running your stress test, here's an opportunity that I can do something really useful rather than just say, oh, I have to do this. How do you get into that mindset?
Well, I'm not sure if this is a direct answer, but I guess for an ICAP, the ultimate test is, does it get used on a day-to-day basis, or, you know, particularly when it comes to strategic decision-making. So it's not so much that the ICAP itself is going to create value for it, but it's going to be part of your thinking when you're making decisions, when you're considering new opportunities, when you're looking at the strategy of the company. I think that's where the real value comes. You know, if it stops someone doing something that is going to put them in any sort of capital risk, or if it encourages a company that they can take a risk because their capital position clearly can withstand it, then to me that's where you get genuine value from ICAP, from a good ICAP framework.
Thank you. So if I finish off with the last question, so you talked about positives and negatives of ICAP. What would you change to just reduce some of those negatives that you talked about? You know, you don't want to use the word compliance, but, you know, processes or requirements?
Look, I think the answer is not a lot. You know, compliance or mandated actions, whatever you call it, you do need to have it. I think the answer that comes to mind is just about the way you communicate it, the way reports are structured, ICAP reports in particular. If you've got that effectively communicated, you know, punctually written, then it can mean a lot to a board member or management. I think
that's great.
Just having a streamlined framework, streamlined reporting.
Thank you. If I can get everyone to just thank Gay for the excellent opening. Thank you. And if everyone could just remember to fill in their feedback forms, that you can do through the app as well.